Welcome to the Undiplomatic Podcast, a podcast about diplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. My name is Hunter Marston, one of your regular co-hosts, and today I'm here with Charles Dunst for a one-on-one interview. Charles is the Deputy Director of Research and Analytics at the Asia Group and an Adjunct Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, in Washington. He has been a correspondent and reported from countries including Cambodia, Myanmar, Vietnam, Israel, Palestine, and Palestinian territories, UAE, Oman, the list goes on. He has written for the New York Times, the Atlantic, the Washington Post, the Telegraph. We've co-authored together previously. And he has a great new book called Defeating the Dictators, How Democracy Can Prevail in the Age of the Strongman. So Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Hunter. I appreciate it.
And before we get started, I just sort of wanted listeners to hear a bit about your background. Which is unique in many ways, because I know you as sort of a Southeast Asia analyst. You and I have collaborated on those sort of country-specific topics before and crisscross paths in Washington. Can you talk about sort of your evolution from a correspondent in Southeast Asia to writing about democracy and sort of big macro themes from Washington?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of an interesting path and definitely not a fully intentional one. I mean, if you had asked me 5 years ago, where would I be in 2023? I probably would have told you, well, I'd be a journalist or either in Asia or in DC or something. And essentially what happened was I picked up and moved to Cambodia to work as a journalist, ended up reporting for many of those publications you mentioned. And it became kind of apparent to me when I was leaving Cambodia and thinking about, well, what's next, that I wasn't going to be able to find a journalism job reporting on foreign policy issues. That's just not really how the structure of journalism operates, where basically I could find a journalism job, maybe, but it'd be covering City Hall in Albany or covering local politics somewhere. And it's not that I don't care about those issues, but I care much more about foreign policy and I care much more about international affairs and thinking about predominantly kind of the U.S. role in these issues. And I realized, well, I need to actually choose between being a foreign policy person or being a journalist. And I chose the foreign policy lens. And because I'd already had a little bit of a career and had this notion of, well, I didn't want to spend so much time going back to do a master's. And of course, a U.S. master's program is incredibly expensive. I ended up in London. Ended up at the London School of Economics doing a master's there because it's 1 year and about, I think if I do my math right, about a 15th of the cost of the US master's or a DC, many of the DC programs. And I was in London doing the master's and then working simultaneously at the LSE's foreign policy think tank and still authoring on the side, some traditional journalism, but as I think that's when we maybe collaborated on some more analytical items. And essentially while I was there, a book agent who had been because he was now an agent on his own, but had been an editor at Penguin UK, approached the LSE Ideas think tank I was working at and said, well, I want to do something on British foreign policy with some of the senior folks or something. And that never materialized, but they kind of shuttled him off to me and said, well, Charles is a journalist. Go talk to Charles and maybe there's something there. And we put together this like 40-page proposal on how the Vietnam War ruined U.S. foreign policy and nobody wanted it because this granted was maybe May 2020. So this was pretty much in the depths of COVID because Jack, my agent, and I met in early March. And basically, we worked on this proposal. Maybe later than that. It was by the end of the summer 2020. And we got pretty strong rejections. And it wasn't that the book wasn't good. It was just there's no audience for this. But this is too academic. There's no audience for it. And what ended up happening was Hodder and Stoughton, the publisher of Defeating the Dictators, reached out to Jack and said, well, you know, we know you kind of as an editor and an agent, and we want a book on autocracy, democracy. We don't know what it's going to be. We want a younger voice. We want a new voice. And we want a voice that's going to actually do something a little bit different. Because many of the democracy, autocracy books out there, I think, as we all know, are very kind of doomsday. Not done always doomsday, but it's in a joke is it's 9 chapters of problems and 1 chapter of solutions. And I think they wanted something very different. They wanted something that thought about solutions. And I think they wanted something from, frankly, a little bit of an unknown voice. And I think at the moment I said, well, I've lived in Hungary. Of course, I've lived in Cambodia. Those are two very different countries, but some autocratic tendencies running through them. I traveled to Singapore. I'm American. I lived in the UK. And their notion was, well, great. This is a lot of experience in a lot of different places. And you might be able to put on paper an argument rooted in these experiences that frankly just many people don't have. So a little bit of an accident in terms of how this all came together, and that I didn't sit down with this great idea for 10 chapters of Defeating the Dictators. It was kind of being in the right place at the right time, but then of course being able to actually do it.
Cool, cool. Thanks for that. Would you say your time in Cambodia or Hungary were really essential for your own intellectual growth? I mean, was it, I guess, a different way to put the question, what I'm getting at is, were you trying to cultivate regional expertise, or were you by nature trying to be a generalist from the start?
I was definitely not trying to be a generalist mm-hmm. from the start. I mean, I, you know me, and my kind of real career on a day-to-day basis is kind of being an Asia hand, particularly a Southeast Asia hand. And I mean, I remember I studied in Hungary in college essentially just because it was the only program where that was pre-approved credit-wise, and I had been a transfer student. So it was kind of this notion of, well, that's the place you can go. And of course, my great-grandfather emigrated from Austria-Hungary. He was an Austrian-Hungarian Jew. So there's a little bit of kind of personal interest in seeing the country kind of, well, part of the country he left. And Cambodia, I mean, I'll never forget. I ran my college newspaper in undergraduate. I was working. I did some freelance kind of opinion articles on U.S. politics and policy. And I remember saying, well, I want to be a journalist after graduation. I want to be a journalist abroad. And the advice I got from, I can't remember who it was, but someone who's an editor, maybe at Foreign Policy, but he was, well, look at Southeast Asia. Because Southeast Asia at the time, this is 2018, had a more open media space than it does now. I mean, most, if you're just thinking about Myanmar, Cambodia, there were more functional journalistic outlets, and it's safe. Southeast Asia is safe, and there's a lot of English speakers. And when there aren't English speakers, there are fixers and translators and journalists who you can hire to kind of co-report a story with you at a fairly affordable rate in comparison to, well, if you don't speak Spanish, you're useless in Latin America. If you don't speak Mandarin, you're useless in China. And I don't speak a second language fluently. I mean, I have the littlest bit of Spanish, but not enough to be useful in Mexico or useful in Guatemala or anything. So I ended up in Cambodia because that was the best job offer. It was this offer at this small magazine to come work for a few hundred bucks a month, enough to pay my rent. And really, from the moment I arrived in Cambodia, I kind of had this realization of, well, I'm going to be a Southeast Asia policy person. I mean, I care a lot about that region. I think it's for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's just dynamic culturally, economically, diplomatically kind of interesting. I'm thinking about how the U.S. engages with a variety of countries, democracies, non-democracies in the region. So definitely did not set out to be a generalist, but now certainly kind of feel like I walk maybe two paths, in the sense of people who actually maybe know me in DC and the kind of the, well, you have known me through CSIS. Whenever I meet with someone from maybe the Australian embassy or the Vietnamese embassy, it's, well, they know me because of my work for CSIS. Mm-hmm. Whereas doing not this podcast, but other podcasts or other kind of webinars or other events around the book, it's, well, you're known as the democracy person. And it's kind of funny walking the two paths, because I think at an event I did today, my friend from the Singaporean embassy was there, and he's like, you know, We like some of what you said in the book, but we dispute any notion that we are not a liberal democracy. And he, you know, he's nice and polite or anything, but it was kind of a funny moment of those two pieces of my career very much interacting in kind of a funny way.
Yeah, well, maybe that's a good transition point, because you start with, in the book, this the Singapore Changi International Airport, right? And you talk about Singapore in a rather sort of glowing way. And I wonder if your bullishness on Singapore as a model sort of glosses over the framing of democracy versus autocracy, and does it risk undermining your argument by saying, well, actually, Singapore stands up well because of governance and not because of democracy per se?
Sure. I mean, I think the reason I opened with Singapore is because Singapore is a unique case study among the autocracies, where even if you're thinking about the other high functioning kind of micro states that are autocracies, you think about the UAE or Qatar. Those all have oil, those all have natural resources, and Singapore does not. And the reason Singapore is what it is because of relatively good governance, and basically from Lee Kuan Yew investing in human capital and infrastructure and having a sound macroeconomic policy, all these things that made it attractive to foreign investors. So I didn't want to say, well, Singapore, I don't think, is a model for the United States. I mean, I'm not, or Australia or Japan. I'm not sitting here saying we need to become more like Singapore. I think that's, even though you hear that a little bit from Silicon Valley types, and that's the famous Brexit commentary. The comment was, we should be Singapore in the tents. I don't really buy that, but I also do think that it is worth thinking about, well, what has Singapore done well? And I think the fact that Singapore has a fairly strong meritocracy in its civil service, or the fact that there's relatively strong investment in human capital education, that's not because Singapore is an autocracy. That's because Singapore was just kind of relatively well-governed from the start, despite being an autocracy. And it's one of the things I said at the end of the book, where I think there's this irony of, well, if you're thinking about what did Singapore do well in terms of meritocracy and capital, whatnot, democracies are actually the best place to implement or to kind of implement some of those best practices, because we have systems set up to control for graft, systems set up to actually advance people meritocratically, theoretically, when they work. Whereas, of course, in an autocracy like China or an autocracy like Russia, the idea that you could have a corruptionless system based on meritocracy is absurd, because the systems are totally rooted around corruption and political patronage. So the argument is not that Singapore is a model for the United States or a model for any advanced democracy. It's more so just looking at how people in democracies currently are kind of lulled by that Singapore model, where when you go to, I mean, I think the clearest example of this is I was doing about 10 days of book events in London. And I was presenting to about 100 people at Parliament. And it was mostly Tory MP staffers, some think tankers, whatever. And I asked the crowd, can 50 of you, can you raise your hand if you've been to Singapore, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, maybe Shenzhen? 50%, 50 people raised their hands. I said, how many of you thought those cities were better governed or better run than the city in which you currently live, whether that's London, Paris, Washington? And the same 50 people raised their hands. So clearly, for some people in democracies, in advanced democracies, there is some allure to Singapore. There is some sense of Singapore as a model, or Singapore as having gotten things right. And I think it's worth, particularly for people in democracies who do not think we should become like Singapore, worth explaining, well, what did Singapore do well? And I think I have definitely did not intend to be, saying Singapore is the greatest place on earth. I don't think it is. I mean, obviously, but that doesn't mean there aren't a few things that Singapore has done well, despite being an autocracy, certainly not because it is an autocracy.
Another country example you dwell on a bit is Vietnam. And it seems like you're drawing out something of a paradox there.
Sure.
So it's an authoritarian country. It's a one-party state, but its government enjoys high public trust. And actually it strives to great lengths to maintain public support for its governance, right? So it seems like there's a distinction you're making between dictators and unelected authoritarian leaders. Is that right?
I think that's largely right. I mean, Vietnam is unique to me because, again, I mean, it's not as well governed as Singapore is. It's not as well governed as the UAE is. It's not as rich. And yet there is this high level of public support that I think stems in large part from kind of performance legitimacy, to kind of borrow the academic term. I think basically if you're Vietnamese and you're 40, 50 years old, or even 30 years old, what the country was when you were a child is unimaginable compared to what it is today. And there is this sense of the government working. And I think the title, obviously, Defeating the Dictators, captures all the autocracies. But in my own thinking, sure, I think there is something very different about a collective leadership system in Vietnam versus a system in China that increasingly seems to revolve around one person. Obviously, in Russia, revolves around one person. And maybe in Saudi Arabia, a little bit more now, revolves around one person in MBS. Those are very different types of governments. And I would argue that the collective governments generally produce better results, even if they are autocracies, where Singapore does not, I mean, since Lee Kuan Yew died, has not revolved around a singular person. Certainly there's a leadership structure, but with one person at the top, but that's the same as in anywhere else. I don't think decisions are made entirely by President Lee. I mean, certainly that's not how this works at the moment. So there is a difference. And I would argue generally that collectively run autocracies are probably likely to have better policy than ones that revolve around a singular person. And probably China's the most famous example, where essentially one could argue that since Xi came to power in 2011, the quality of policymaking has declined both at home and abroad. Whereas when you had some collective leadership in the late 90s, or the 90s and 2000, early 2000s, that China was just better placed geopolitically and economically.
Right. And I'll move to China in a minute. how are we to reconcile the sort of high public support for authoritarian government based on governance with the sort of dark side of authoritarianism in countries like Vietnam, where human rights critics or activists can be locked up, disappeared, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the fact that Singapore, or sorry, the fact that Vietnam has relatively high levels of public trust means we should overlook the kind of human rights issues. The same goes for Singapore, UAE. I think, but the fact that there is such public support four non-democratic governments, I think is actually a little bit worrisome and should make clear to the West that some of the notions, I think, follow. I mean, notions are kind of gone already, but really I think the notion was bought into at the end of the Cold War, and arguably since up until maybe the mid to 2010s, that essentially as people got richer, they would just want democracy is just not true. Right. And I'm not the first one to say it. I think Thailand is one of the clear examples where Thailand, when it had this middle class, everyone thought the middle class would demand democracy. And so the middle class was like, I actually want to consolidate my gains with some type of stable autocracy. And that's right. Really why I wanted to point out the public support those non-democratic governments have, mm-hmm. because it so flies in the face of, I think, many of the assumptions we make in Washington and definitely in the UK of this notion of, well, of course, the democracies will just have more public trust because we have feedback mechanisms and we have accountability at the ballot box, when in reality, that's just not true. I think the question of, well, Vietnam reports something like 93% of public trust in government. I would say that maybe 30% of that number is due to a warped media space or due to people basically saying what they think they need to say to kind of please the government. But even if you say that's 30, 40%, that still puts trust in the government around 50, 55, 60%, which is still higher than almost every democracy. I mean, the US is at 28, 29. The UK is around 28, 29, maybe 30. Even Japan and Korea are in the 30s or low 40s. So even if you're having the number of Vietnam, it's still higher than most democracies. And I think sometimes we don't think about that so much because it's a little bit of a difficult thing for us to reconcile into notion that, and to realize that I think this is my own personal view, that people much prefer economic development over democracy. I think you're seeing that around the world. And I think you're seeing that in at least some part. I'm not an India expert, but I think that is clearly what kind of the power of the BJP demonstrates, when you can attach some kind of ethnic issues to economic nationalism or to economic promises or to actual development, you can get a really strong kind of illiberal leader or a liberal government.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in Vietnam, they people in Hanoi would tell me about the strong connection between economic development and national security, because human security ultimately for them and party legitimation revolves around delivering economic growth to people. And, you know, on sort of in line with what you were just saying about Vietnam, actually, ironically, support for General Secretary Nguyen Phu Trong and his unprecedented third term in the country is buttressed by his anti-corruption drive, which actually has quite a strong popular backing in the country. Maybe we can move to China, actually. So how does China's rise, or how has China's rise complicated support for democracy globally?
Sure. I think it's slowing a little bit now, but my argument is essentially that China's rise as an economic model for the developing world in particular has definitely weakened the allure of democracy, where I think at the end of the Cold War, maybe through the mid-2000s-ish, kind of maybe to really until 2008, actually, I would argue, there was this belief that, well, liberal democracies, or at least democracies, had the path to prosperity, that you needed rule of law, you needed democratic checks that would allow your private sector to flourish, and that would allow your country to get rich. And with those profits and that tax revenue, you could build roads and all that. And I think China really shattered that, and China made clear that there is a pretty obvious illiberal, undemocratic path to prosperity and path to wealth and path to power. And certainly the Gulf states do that to some extent. Singapore has done it to some extent, but Vietnam in many ways kind of is following the China model that was established years ago. And I think, I mean, you and I probably both heard this, that when you travel around Southeast Asia and you talk to maybe Cambodian policymakers or even Thai policymakers, Indonesian policymakers, the comment is, well, we want Singapore's effective governance and we want China's double-digit growth rates.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not we want democracy. I mean, it's not we want liberal values or liberal governance. It's we want wealth. We want economic development. And we think China has demonstrated for countries like us in China's backyard how to best do that. And that's a very different problem if you're sitting in Washington or Westminster. That's a very different problem than during the Cold War, where the Soviet Union just didn't provide that path to prosperity. I mean, the Soviet Union was a strong military power. It was a massive country. It could certainly kind of hold some influence in the developing world. But no one from Minneapolis went to Moscow and thought, that's great. We should emulate that. Mm-hmm. Or certainly you hear of Americans who go to Shenzhen and come home and say, well, why doesn't Detroit look like that? Or why doesn't New York look like that at this point? And I think that's a fundamentally different challenge that really does come from China and to a lesser extent, Singapore, the Gulf states, these kind of quote unquote successful autocracies. I mean, certainly, I'm sure we both have, and for the more so, I actually think for Europe, because it's closer, but the Europeans come back from Dubai and are like, why is London not like this? Why is Berlin not like this? And I think it's a fair question, but the fact that it's autocracies who seem to have kind of owned the future, kind of led by China, is deeply troubling to me. And essentially, why is that about to write the book?
Right. So is there a connection in your mind between this sort of, you know, say Xi Jinping's model in particular and the rise of populists within America? I mean, is there any narrative within the US or Western democracies that looks to China as a model, or is China more of a model in the minds of Southeast Asia, which is far more integrated or reliant on China's economy in many ways?
I think China is much more of a model for developing countries. And I think we all kind of can see that in daily conversations with Southeast Asian policymakers and even kind of policymakers elsewhere or think tankers elsewhere. That doesn't mean, it certainly has not picked up the same steam, I think, in the West. But there is a bit of China envy. I mean, I think there's some quote from 2016 when Trump was running his first campaign, said something to the effect of, China builds bridges like nobody else. They build bridges so much better than we do. And why can't we build bridges like that anymore? It's a little simplistic. But I think there is this notion, this kind of bubbling sense of China just being able to do things faster and better. I think what's ironic is, I haven't heard that so much in Europe, but the kind of call for autocracy that I've heard a little bit in Europe is these prominent scholars. I mean, you kind of understand the case on the right. I don't think I need to explain why there's this illiberal right-wing case for autocracy. It's more so rooted around, I think, kind of ethnic and social concerns. But there's this far left case rooted around climate change, where these influential, I think, French and Danish scholars who've written books and Guardian articles essentially arguing that climate change is bigger than democracy. And that because we are, our democratic politics are so sclerotic and so messy, we won't be able to solve climate change as is. So we need like a green dictator. We need a dictator to come in with the power to say, you know, you can't drive X, Y, and Z car. You can't go on more than two or three vacations a year to limit emissions. And I think the argument there, well, that argument makes no sense to me, because you're essentially, you know, once you allow a green dictator, you're kind of allowing green gulags. Like, I don't think there's a way around that. But that is an interesting kind of smaller, but still fairly prominent case that I've heard made in Europe, in addition to kind of this, the cultural issues that you hear on the right, and then to some extent this China envy of, well, we just need to build bridges or infrastructure like they do.
Right. And of course, China is one of the biggest polluters in the world, so not the best model of dictatorship. You know, that makes me think of the way Build Back Better and the Biden administration's public policies have been securitized, and the way that industrial policy or industrial economic, industrial-led, sort of state-led economic governance is back in vogue in a way in Washington. Of course, it's hitched to a strategy of primacy and competition with China. But a different way of putting that is that a strategy of primacy is a necessary condition for domestic renewal and industrial policy at the moment. Do you think that trade-off is worthwhile or sustainable?
I think it's worthwhile. I'm not sure it's sustainable. And I know that's kind of splitting hairs, but I think in the current moment to say, well, we need to do all of these things because we have a really clear challenger, and here are all these clear examples of why, if that's going to spur meaningful action, which it seemingly has on chips, on the IRA, which is electric vehicles, things that are actually good policy, if that's what it's going to take to get bipartisan action, that's fine. For the moment, I think that's the worthwhile trade-off. But at some point, there's going to need to be a messaging shift for the American people, because there is no guarantee that the kind of this current state of competition with China is going to persist for 40, 50 years. Although maybe, I mean, I kind of think the state of competition we're in is the state of competition we're going to be in for a while. But I think there needs to be a thought process of, well, if there isn't this kind of big problem out there in China, what is the rationale for all of this? How do we explain it to the American people who are not reading Foreign Affairs or reading Foreign Policy magazine, not reading these kind of relatively niche DC outlets or anything? How do we explain it to ordinary people? And I think the argument has to be, well, here's how electric vehicles are going to make your community safer and cheaper and cleaner. Or here's why we need chips. Here's why you need chips that are made in the United States, because maybe there's this power out there that won't give them to us. Or, you know, we don't want to be relying on the world for all these critical things. So I think for the moment, it's worthwhile. I think for the moment, getting someone like John Cornyn on board with, you know, investment in the private sector to build chips for a kind of a staunch conservative, the fact that the China framing is getting him there and making these things possible, I think that's a positive. But in the long term, you need to have an explanation for strong industrial policy beyond just kind of competition with China.
Right, right. And we saw some of this framing evolve around sort of the late stage of the Obama administration trying to sell the Trans-Pacific Partnership belatedly at home with sort of this competition with China, and it will allow us to set the rules of the game, not China. You know, that it hinges on political pragmatism, of course. So point taken. So there's this bipartisan consensus around great power competition at the moment. Actually, what you were just saying makes me think of that an argument Ali Wine has made before, that, you know, we have a great power opportunity as well, and that competition with China can't sort of be competition for its own sake, but if it allows us to mobilize domestic renewal, it could be worthwhile in the short term, as long as we have guardrails for sort of a long-term strategy. Do you think there are different visions between Democrats and Republicans for how they see America standing in the world?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think I broadly also agree with Ali's argument there, that I think that is largely right. But in terms of thinking about Democrats versus Republicans, I sometimes struggle to define them, in the sense of, I think for Democrats, obviously there's splits within the party, but I think most folks are kind of on board with the Biden administration's approach of, well, not only do we need to kind of talk the talk, we need to walk the walk and be a little bit more committed to the rules-based order in practice, that we need to actually live up to these ideals rather than just talk about them, that we need to, you know, strengthen ties with our Democratic and like-minded partners, but also kind of maintain our values and maintain all this stuff. But I think there is this sense of, yeah, we need to actually abide by the rules we're setting for ourselves, because the point of this order cannot just be U.S. primacy, because why would anyone else sign up to that? It needs to be, the point of this order is actually giving other countries sovereignty and choice. And I think you see that with a country like Vietnam, that's certainly not a democracy, but broadly signed up to be the rules-based order because they think this U.S.-led, Western-led system gives them the greatest opportunity to have sovereignty and choice. And I think that is broadly the Democratic model, the Democratic Party model. I think the Republicans are fairly aligned on that. But, I mean, again, it's a little hard because I think there are almost two or three Republican parties, in the sense of, it's hard for me to define what is the kind of the Trump wing's ideal U.S. foreign policy. I mean, certainly it's no trade deals. It's pushing partners and allies like Vietnam on issues of the trade deficit, even though that's probably not in our strategic interest. It's probably not pushing on human rights issues at all with partners like Vietnam, or even partners like India. It's certainly more militarized. I think it's less priority on maybe, you know, bringing Marcos to the White House, just because bringing someone to the White House is like a very nice soft power thing, and it demonstrates the president's attention. And I think it does win you friends, where I'm not sure that wing of the party thinks, oh, we need to invite the guy from the Philippines. Like, that's not worth our time. We only need to invite like our few allies, our few friends. But then if you think about the more mainstream kind of Republican Party, even if I think that's smaller, so maybe folks like, I'm forgetting his name, that's terrible, the chairman of the China Committee in the House. I think
Joe McCarthy.
The China Committee.
Oh.
I'm forgetting, that's terrible. But I think his general proposition is fairly similar to the Democrats, but again, Mike Gallagher, thank you. Slightly more militarized and probably slightly more hawkish on China, in the sense of, I think Democrats, most Democrats, again, if you're sitting in Washington, say, you know, we don't want to sell these dual use military goods to China. We don't want to sell advanced semiconductors that will help them build advanced missiles or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And we don't want links to forced labor. We don't import goods with links to forced labor in Xinjiang, all these things. I think the Republicans might draw the line on what goods are too sensitive to sell to China a little bit closer to kind of civilian goods, where I think for many of the Democrats, and I think I would probably agree with this, that this selling consumer cars to China is not a problem. The fact that the NBA has such an investment in China is not a problem in itself. Whereas I think there are many Republicans who would say, you know, we should be doing no business in China. We're really slashing our business in China because any business with China is kind of immoral. And I don't believe that. I think many Democrats say that's not reasonable. It's too big an economy. And, you know, some of these people with the people of cultural ties are really important for whatever future there is kind of after Xi and after this kind of era of competition. So I think that's there are multiple foreign policies within these parties, but that's kind of how I would define the picture of me sitting here in Washington.
Right. So related question, you know, with elections coming up next year, what happens to U.S. policy? And sure. How does this impact your argument if sort of we see a return to Trump or Trumpism, you know, with the MAGA right wing? Will American policy simply revert to sort of America first and everyone else can get fucked?
I mean, it's pessimistic, but I don't think it's not wrong. I mean, I have a hard time imagining that a Trump administration or someone aligned with him would be convening a democracy summit. I have a hard time thinking that there would be much engagement kind of with, I mean, even when this recent meeting at the Philippines, certainly human rights and democracy were on top of the agenda, but they were raised. I mean, in the highest level meetings, there were discussions between the president and Marcos on labor issues, on human rights issues. I don't think a Trump administration is doing any of that. So certainly, I mean, the idea that of a Trump administration that is kind of hostile to, theoretically kind of hostile to rule of law at home would be hostile to rule of law and democracy abroad, and certainly would undermine any of the goals I've offered in this book or any of the kind of ideas that I think we should adopt. But honestly, what was kind of refreshing about writing this book was because I knew it was at least mostly kind of for a US, UK publisher first, and then kind of being distributed around the world, that I had to write it not just for a US audience. And as much as Trump is there, it was nice to not have to actually mention President Trump so much, because I could say, well, this book is not only just for Americans, it is for Europeans, it is for Northeast Asians, it is for Southeast Asians, whatever. So certainly I think a Trump return or a return of Trump would damage many of these priorities. I think what's arguably a more interesting kind of game plan in theory as well, if Nikki Haley's president, which I think is unlikely, but either Nikki Haley or a Tim Scott that is more traditional kind of Republican and I think not hostile to democracy and the rule of law, what does their foreign policy look like? Particularly thinking about Asia. And I don't have a great answer. I mean, I think clearly for Nikki Haley and for Tim Scott, there's like a ton of support for Israel, pushing more stuff like the Abraham Accords. Like, I think we all kind of understand that. There may be kind of increased interest in some more hawkish stuff on China, cajoling the Europeans to get on board. But what does an Indo-Pacific policy for Nikki Haley look like? I mean, it doesn't comprise trade. It probably comprises more of the same with less talking about democracy, honestly. So it's kind of an open question to me. I don't think anyone's really defined what a traditional or normal Republican foreign policy on Asia would look like, because what I think most Asian countries want is trade with the United States. And I think they've joined the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, hoping that maybe sometime down the line that turns into market access or opportunities. But clearly, if you're, you know, a Republican winning that nomination, I think you're winning that nomination because you are not promising free trade. So I think it's a little bit of an open question.
Yeah. Amen to that. So, you know, zooming out a bit, what's productive about this whole democracy versus autocracy framing? As you mentioned, Biden's been courting partners in Vietnam, the Philippines, Marcos Jr., and Marcos is the son of a former dictator and U.S. ally. So we have sort of defied this binary that we've ourselves, or the Biden administration itself, has set up for its foreign policy. But your book, in many ways, seems to be advancing this values-based foreign policy. Do you think there's sort of an in-between, or is there sort of an inherent value in restoring democracy to the centerpiece of foreign policy?
I think that messaging, arguably the democracy versus autocracy framing, I think is honestly mostly for a domestic audience in the United States. I think it is for the President Biden supporters and for maybe not folks kind of in the middle of saying, for us, democracy is critically important. It was not for the previous administration. We need to reestablish the most powerful in the world, powerful democracies in the democracy in the world. We need to reestablish our own democracy, and we need to at least consider it central in our foreign policy. But if there is obviously this question of, is it productive? Because I think I hear from Singaporean diplomats or Vietnamese diplomats who say, well, we don't appreciate being left out of the summit for democracy. We don't appreciate being kind of thought of as secondary. And certainly I imagine there's some kind of senior Asia folks in the government who are thinking, well, we'd much prefer this to not be the number one framing. So I would say, I think it's productive in the sense that it does remind partners who the United States is, in the sense of countries do expect more from us than they expect from China. I mean, no one expects China to have, you know, an excellent track record or even an okay track record on religious freedom or minority rights. Where when you talk to, you know, Indonesian diplomats, they say, you know, we expect the United States to be this kind of multicultural haven and to be, you know, more open to Muslim citizens or whatever. I mean, you hear that from countries around the world, that there is this expectation of the United States being better and just kind of living up to our values. And you think about the democracy versus autocracy framing, what it reminds me of, and I think it actually in many ways dates back to the Obama administration, it reminds me of the 2014, I think, Obama trip to Vietnam. When Obama said to the Vietnamese, you know, we respect different political systems. And that was this notion of, well, we're not going to come in and overthrow your government. But in return, Obama said, you know, you have to respect ours. And our political system, our democratic character is so deeply rooted in who the United States is and what the United States is, that we're not gonna not talk about it, that we're not gonna not talk about human rights, and we're not gonna not talk about democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not a binary in saying, well, because you're an autocracy, we can't be friends. That's not the binary. I don't think it's ever been the binary. And as much as my book is arguing in favor of democracy and fixing democracy at home, in the conclusion, I very explicitly said, you know, we have autocratic partners and we need to keep engaging them. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that our relationships are in their strategic benefit. But there are more autocracies in the world than there are democracies. The idea that we can kind of sit here in a small little club and say, no, we only need to engage our maybe 30, 40% of the world is not realistic and would not be smart foreign policy. So as much as the framing, I think, can maybe irritate partners sometimes, I would argue that most actually kind of get it. I think most partners do understand that this is mostly domestic messaging. And they do understand that the United States is going to push them on human rights and democracy stuff, even if kind of slightly more politely and privately, as in the case of Vietnam, where we raise these issues fairly delicately, whereas in the case of Cambodia, it's angry White House statements whenever someone goes to prison or whenever the election's fraudulent. And I think that's maybe less productive, but the private pushing on kind of cultural issues, on labor rights, I think that is okay. But it's interesting to me is I think the real divide, as much as the president and the White House kind of talk about democracy versus autocracy in foreign policy, the real divide is between what countries adopt the rules-based order abroad or want the rules-based order abroad and which ones don't. And that is, again, the clear Vietnam example, where Vietnam is not a democracy at all. Vietnam very much wants the rules-based order, and they want this order kind of at least broadly run by the United States, because I think it gives them the best chance at economic development and economic security and then national security and defense against China and all these things. And I think that's what you're increasingly seeing, I think, with the Biden administration's approach of catering to and kind of engaging countries, illiberal and liberal, democratic and non-democratic, that are willing to at least broadly support this order that protects sovereignty and all these things. And I think that's really the most key framing at the moment for the United States in our foreign policy. I think really that's what folks are thinking about, and who are we prioritizing? It's who supports the rules-based order. And I think clearly that's mostly democracies, but not solely at all.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, of course, that has implications for some U.S. partners. You know, for instance, U.S.-Saudi quasi-alliance, right? I mean, how does Saudi Arabia uphold the rules-based order? Why do we still have such deep ties to authoritarian countries in the Middle East, right? Do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Saudi example is an interesting one, because I don't think they particularly hold the rules-based order. And I think, frankly, people are beginning to realize that. And that's the war in Yemen. I mean, I'm probably on the more progressive end of the spectrum. I'm like, the U.S. should not be supporting the war in Yemen. That's my own personal opinion. Not that I'm a Middle East expert, but I think that's where I would land on that. And I think it's very easy to say the Saudis are not upholding the rules-based order. I think that's very, very clear. I think you could probably extend that to a few other Middle Eastern countries. But, you know, I always think back to a country like Jordan. Jordan is a monarchy. I think Jordan is broadly supportive of the rules-based order in the sense of resolving conflicts peacefully, sovereignty, whatever, all of that. I think the Saudi question is kind of unanswered, and I wonder where the Saudi relationship stands in 2 years or in 4 years if President Biden is reelected, because as much as he made that visit to get more oil from Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia did not give more oil. And I don't see closer engagement happening there really anytime soon. I think, honestly, the UAE, to some extent, has begun to fill that Void as the more preferred U.S. partner. But then again, the UAE obviously funnels money from, you know, dictatorships around the world. And I think we've sanctioned a bunch of UAE companies for violating Russia sanctions. So I think there are some autocracies stepping up, honestly, to fill the gap left by Saudi. But I'd be very surprised if the Saudi relationship, U.S.-Saudi relationship, is as strong in 2, 4, 6, 8 years as it was during either the Biden or then the Trump, or sorry, the Obama or then the Trump administration. And I think that's a reaction, not only to kind of Saudi autocracy at home, it's a reaction to the Saudi Arabia not being a predictable or helpful partner in comparison to Jordan, which is a predictable and helpful partner, or even in comparison to Singapore, predictable and helpful partner. Even if they're balancing U.S. and China, fine. But we need autocracies that actually do broadly support the order in one way or another. And clearly, Saudi Arabia, I think, does not.
Right. In a country like Vietnam, which we talked about briefly, of course, really does make consistent appeals to the rules-based international order because they need international law to ensure their own security. They constantly appeal to UNCLOS, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, in their maritime disputes, territorial disputes with China. But of course, you know, the U.S. is not simply upholding the international order and playing by all the rules of the game. It itself hasn't signed on to UNCLOS, for instance. And of course, the Trump administration withdrew from a number of nuclear treaties and arms control treaties, which put some guardrails on the relationships with or rivalry with Russia, for instance, dating back to the Cold War. So what happens if, you know, we have a future president of the United States who starts really dismantling the rules-based order from starting from pulling the U.S. out of international treaties?
I think there are two options. I think the first option is the really pessimistic one, where essentially without the world's largest, richest democracy, well, not largest, without the world's richest democracy kind of upholding the rules-based order, that it kind of just crumbles and that we end up in some type of like really multipolarity, but a multipolar system in which there's kind of a, you know, their own, an order in Southeast Asia, an order in South Asia, whatever, an order in Central America and all that. That's kind of the pessimistic one, because I think that would be not only bad for business and kind of bad for economic ties, it would obviously be bad, I think, for actual disputes, kind of physical military disputes. But that's the pessimistic version. The optimistic version is that at least in some regions, you have other kind of greater powers step up to establish an order. And I think you saw a little bit of that from Japan. When we left TPP, the Abe administration said, no, we're going to do that. Like, we are going to do that, and we are going to build this architecture. We are going to set the rules and set the rules of the road in the Indo-Pacific, and I guess including Chile as well, even if the United States does not want to. And I think that is the optimistic version, is that at least in some parts of the world, there are countries that are currently U.S. partners or currently benefit from the rules-based order that think it's in their own interest to uphold it. And I would argue that if the United States disappeared today in Asia, in the Indo-Pacific, I think you would have Japan, you would have Australia, maybe to a lesser extent New Zealand, and to a slightly lesser extent South Korea, step up pretty immediately and say, you know, we are going to build this regional architecture. Certainly, I'm not sure they currently have the defense capacity to do all of it, but they would at least say, you know, it's in our interest to maintain some form of this order, if even without U.S. military power. But that's obviously the overarching problem, is are they ready? Are they ready to do that without us? And I think that's kind of the nightmare scenario that no one is hoping for. But I think there are at least some positive signs in Asia of Asian countries taking on their own agency to build up an order and build up a rules-based order that doesn't necessarily always include the United States. And I think that's positive. But are there other parts of the world in which that's happening? Not really. I mean, BRICS is illiberal. ASEAN is mostly illiberal. The Arab League is very much a liberal and is now welcoming Syria back into the fold. I think outside of the irony is, as much as the Indo-Pacific is not a particularly democratic region, that you have a few very powerful, very committed democratic countries that are interested in building that rules-based order kind of with or without the United States.
Right. Well, the scenario you describe with the sort of U.S., I mean, this is hypothetical, of course, with the U.S. suddenly absent, you know, on the world stage, it's probably not the most realistic one. It seems you describe this sort of multipolar regional order or international order as an inherently unstable one, which I think matches sort of the general international relations literature, and which sees bipolarity as inherently more stable, and unipolarity or multipolarity as unstable, given the power contestation that it creates. But in some ways, it seems like Southeast Asians are hoping or already see the region as one that's multipolar, right? They look to these partners you name, Australia, Japan, Korea, as a means of sort of hedging their bets and diversifying away from reliance too much on the superpowers. So is multipolarity in your mind inherently a bad thing, or is it sort of the way the world is going already?
I mean, I think I'm not sure that I would agree that Southeast Asia is already multipolar. I think I would more so say that Southeast Asia is fairly bipolar, but countries don't trust either of the bipolar countries, so are kind of looking to diversify beyond that. But just because you're looking to diversify and have relationships with countries besides the two great powers doesn't necessarily mean to me that it's multipolar. Because I think if you actually think about the region, who has the greatest power? It is by leaps and bounds still China and the United States, where even you think about Japan and Australia, they are kind of down, further down the tier in terms of economic power, in terms of military power. So I do still kind of think it is a bipolar contest. But there is interest in saying, well, we don't actually, you know, trust China on security stuff. The U.S. is not really helping us on economics and trade. So let's diversify across the board. You know, let's buy weapons from Australia. Let's do trade deals with India, whatever. So I'm not sure if you're actually thinking about, well, is that system stable? I mean, it's kind of, it's stable till it's not, in the sense of I'm maybe a believer that the current U.S.-China competition, as long as there are some communication channels there, and which currently kind of are, and as long as China does not move to take Taiwan, I think it's actually an ironically fairly stable moment where there is this fair reasonable stability of neither country. If you remove Taiwan from the kind of debate stage, neither country is looking to go to war with the other. I mean, there are no serious American policymakers who want to go to war with China, and I think you'd actually get much of that on the Chinese side either. And also, I mean, it mostly just revolves around Taiwan. So I think it is actually a little bit more stable than the Cold War was, in the sense of I think it's very easy to sit in the West and say, oh, the Cold War was stable for us. Well, Cold War was not stable for Southeast Asia. The Cold War was not stable for much of Central America. It was certainly not stable for Africa. And with some minimal exceptions of like Syria, maybe Myanmar to a little bit, you don't have those proxy conflicts in the way you used to. I mean, you do not have, you know, a national security advisor like Henry Kissinger, like, running around Southeast Asia, dropping bombs on Cambodia. Like, you just don't have that. So it's kind of a long-winded answer of saying that I actually think the current system is a bit stable, which I would argue is kind of like, on a broad scale, I'm actually of the believer that globally, it's still kind of a unipolar system. I mean, that's a little silly, but in the notion that there is just no country with to match the military power or kind of just the overall economic power of the United States. Even, and just because China is closer than before does not mean to me that it's bipolar. I think bipolar implies a relative sense of equality between two powers, and clearly that's not the case in terms of, you know, China cannot shut a country off the SWIFT system or cannot shut a country off the dollar clearing system and kind of make the country poor at the kind of snap in its fingers. And China does not have the same military capacity or the military technology that the United States does. That's not a reason to be kind of sitting on laurels and just kind of move on with it. I think the fact, I mean, China is catching up. China has historically caught up. But broadly, I think we're in kind of an increasingly contested unipolar order is kind of how I would describe it. But that's, of course, very, very wonky and very much splitting hairs. And I think it is deceptively stable, but that stability, the elephant in the room is, of course, Taiwan. I think that's kind of, for me at least, where if China was to, you know, move to invade Taiwan tomorrow, I have no idea how the world responds, but clearly not in a way that would be stable in terms of economics, in terms of defense, all of that.
Right. Your conclusion gets to the Taiwan question and various contingency scenarios. How does America's democracy or perhaps relative decline towards autocracy impact, or what's the connection to the China-Taiwan dilemma, which you're getting at in the conclusion? Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I think the argument is that if the United States is so hobbled by lacking investment in infrastructure, lacking investment in human capital, a declining meritocracy, that we kind of see more illiberal anti-democratic leaders come to power both nationally and locally, and then kind of, you know, we're so busy dealing with the ramifications of that in Washington and state houses across the country, it really will undermine our ability to practically respond to a crisis in Taiwan, or to practically support even other, I mean, obviously Taiwan's not an ally, but to support an ally like Japan, to support an ally like the Philippines, to support an ally like North Korea. I mean, in the, you know, drastic apocalypse scenario of North Korea moves to invade South Korea or something, you know, could the United States do a draft to send people to South Korea under, there's no world. I mean, there's no world in which there's enough trust in the US government right now to draft people into the government to send them to fight in a foreign country. And of course, you know, fewer people are joining the military, partially because they don't trust the government, they don't believe in the government. So there are all these ramifications of declining confidence in the American system that will weaken our ability to practically respond, in addition to the values-based proposition and the kind of model problem of, well, if the United States can't function and can't deliver for its people, why would people around the world want to be like us? I mean, that's kind of a baseline question, where if people feel like, well, American life expectancy is going down, American infrastructure is declining, the meritocracy is declining, they're no longer producing the world's best innovations. If you're kind of a young member of the intelligentsia in Hanoi thinking about what you want your country to look like in 60 years, why would you say we want it to look at the United States? I mean, it really is, it's not only just practical performance at home, but it's performance legitimacy for the United States and for other democracies, UK, whatever, to serve as a model abroad. And both of those impact the Taiwan scenario. Most clearly, I think, the first one, where if the United States is just completely hobbled and riven by domestic politics and domestic disputes, there's not going to be enough buy-in to send troops or even meaningful support to back Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. So given what you've said about sort of declining support for American governance and its ability to deliver as a democracy, as well as visible signs of crumbling infrastructure, you know, I've been away in Australia for nearly 4 years, and in the back of my mind I sort of expected WMATA to be fixed by the time I get home, and I hear it's as bad as ever in DC's public transportation system, of course. But it seems like you're still making the case democracy has an inherent advantage. Yet, given the fact that there are so many people who would be quick to lament democracy's failures here, the shortcomings we've touched upon, how is democracy still poised to win, given the success of cities like Shenzhen you mentioned?
Sure. I think democracies are poised to win, but we'll have to win it, in the sense that it's not, democracy is not going to automatically win. Democracy doesn't automatically function. I think faith in democracy's automatic functioning has become a little bit of a problem. But still, I mean, you think about, well, the United States has not invested in human capital particularly well. Our education system's not as good as it used to be. Our infrastructure's not as good, whatever. We still are one of the world's most innovative countries. People, immigrants from all over the world still list us as the number one destination. There are all these things that we still do incredibly well, despite not governing particularly effectively. And I think that's just a remarkable testament to the fact of democracy's ability to rejuvenate itself. And I think it will require more investments, obviously. It will require fixing the education system and all these things. But I think the way I described it in the book is democracy's problems are fundamentally political, in that it is about political failures and kind of politicians not governing as well as they should. Whereas I think for autocracies, many of the problems are actually pretty existential, where if you're thinking in the Chinese system, well, how do we boost our population, or how do we attract immigrants? The reason you're not attracting immigrants is because you are a closed one-party system that people just don't see as particularly dynamic. You're not home to the world's greatest innovations. You're not home to the world's greatest art and all of this and all the cultural exports. And I think what's always remarkable to me is in Southeast Asia, the music you see on TVs or the music you hear around bars is American and Korean. It's not Chinese music, which is always so odd to think about given the proximity, the cultural ties. What I'm saying, it is K-pop. It's K-pop and it's American music and maybe some British music if you want to include Ed Sheeran or whatever. But it's a remarkable testament to me of the way democracies continue to, I think, produce much of the world's best across a variety of sectors, despite relative misgovernance. I think the joke I used on a podcast a few days ago is, well, you know, there's a reason why the Saudi, Qatari, and Emirati billionaires, billionaires, all want to buy the British soccer teams rather than kind of set up fancy leagues of their own, because they say, well, they've already just done it better. Let's just take that. And there's a reason why, you know, the Jordanian king or the Singaporean elite send their kids to study at Oxford or Cambridge or Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, you know, Australia, because there's this sense of democracy still being able to do things better. And I think we just have more capacity than autocracies do. And this is not to say autocracies can't do things well. Of course, there are great novelists that have come out of the Soviet Union, the great innovations coming out of China. But I would argue on the broad scale that democracies do have the advantage, but it is on us to actually seize that advantage with smart policymaking and all that.
Right. So then it seems that it would be inherently a major obstacle to this project of renewing democracy and sort of renewing democracy's competitive edge abroad were we to elect authoritarians or election deniers at home, right? You mentioned how you had the opportunity to sort of get outside of America, avoid Trump with this book. But how essential is it that we work on improving democracy at home, and what can we do about the election, the presence of election deniers or those who are seeking to undermine democratic institutions within the US?
Yeah, man, I think it's critical. I mean, when you think about the viability of the American model abroad, I mean, January 6th was a crisis. I mean, January 6th, if you're sitting in Singapore and you're sitting in Vietnam and you feel like American diplomats have preached to you for years the benefits of democracy, you're looking at January 6th and thinking, well, what are they talking about? And the same goes for folks thinking, you know, look at the United Kingdom and seeing three prime ministers in 3 months, 15% inflation, 18% grocery store inflation. I mean, there is this notion of, well, why would we ever want that? So clearly it is a problem. I mean, the basic ability of the United States to remain a democracy is critical to this notion of democracy promotion abroad. And I think certainly maybe some countries can fill the gap and maybe do more, but Japan historically has not had a values-focused foreign policy. And you think that Southeast Asia, Japan has long had very close ties with Myanmar and Thailand and Cambodia, precisely because they don't focus on a values issue. So there is no country, I think, that maybe always, generally, historically, has placed democracy and kind of values as so central to foreign policy, even if we're not always consistent, but not. So the ability of the United States to actually be that democratic model is really critical. And the fact that there are more election deniers, that there is January 6th, is clearly undermining that process. I mean, I don't have a great answer, a great solution for, you know, how do you remove kind of electoral deniers? How do you vote them out and replace them? I think the critical item I said in the book is, well, as much as people get frustrated with the system, as much as I get frustrated with the system and feel like politics aren't working, there's a critical need to just remain engaged and keep voting. Because I think what happens if you don't, I mean, it's kind of a very simple point, but if you don't vote, your congressperson sitting in the United States will represent an even smaller swath of the citizenry. And that congressperson will thus have even less of an idea of what their people want, less of an idea of what the constituents actually need. So they'll get into office and they'll cater to that 30% of the district that voted for them and leave the 70% out to dry. And of course that 70% will become even increasingly even more distrustful. Because the politicians are not mind readers in the sense that they're not going to be able to fulfill your goals unless you actually vote and tell them what your goals are. But the fact that people just tune out and say, well, politics, it's not for me. I'm going to kind of focus on myself. It does weaken trust in government. I think it sets up what I've called this mistrust cycle that will just only further, I think, democratic decay. So I know it's a cliche, but I do think the continued voting is really critical. And what's troubling to me is also, it's not voting just in presidential elections. I mean, I'm always troubled by the number of friends I have or folks who have, you know, master's degrees who just like don't vote in local elections, who don't vote for their mayor, their county representative, whatever. And that stuff is really critical because democracy doesn't function without democratic citizens. And it's really, I think that's what it comes down to. But beyond that, yeah, I don't have all the solutions for America's ills, but I think my hope is that at least when you think about the kind of Trump supporter or kind of election denier part of the party, I'm optimistic. And I think I would say maybe 20% of that party is unwinnable. And 25% of that party is always going to kind of support the Trump types, the electoral deniers. And that's rooted in ethnic issues. It's rooted in kind of American nationalism, whatever you want to call it. I think there is a broad swath of voters that might not be convinced to vote for a Democrat, but could be convinced to not vote for an election denier, and could be convinced that, well, if the system is already working better, if the infrastructure is improving, if the human capital is improving, if they feel the system's more meritocratic and there is more social mobility, maybe they could be peeled away from the electoral denier, the election deniers, who are kind of using those fears to prop themselves up, or using the idea of decline to prop up themselves. So I know that's more optimistic than many folks are, but I do think the 2022 midterms were kind of demonstrative of that the Republicans did lose support. I think enough people said, you know, I'm a normal conservative. I don't sign up for this. I don't sign up for chaos, and I don't sign up for January 6th and whatever. So maybe there is some silver linings there, I would hope.
Yeah, well, getting back to your sort of origin story as well, probably we need to give some thought to renewing faith in and investment in local journalism, right? Because otherwise, how will people know and care about these issues and elections in their hometown?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's a pretty critical problem that, you know, every country has taken a variety of steps. I think Australia has now introduced this rule where social media companies have to actually pay news outlets for the content they use, which is an interesting way of actually boosting journalists' revenue and actually making them, you know, quasi profitable. But that's a separate tangent. I could give you another hour on how, you know, media is no longer profitable and how someone has to essentially step in like a Jeff Bezos to make them function, unless they're the New York Times. But separate problem, definitely damaging to democracy. I can leave it there.
Great. Well, seeing as we've been going on for nearly an hour, what's the next book project? Are you keeping with the sort of broad global problems, or are you going back to Southeast Asia?
So I always joke that the book I want to do is a book no one will ever read. I would love to do a biography of Hun Sen, of Cambodia's prime minister. I know Sebastian Strangio has written a little bit, I think, like a Cambodia book that discusses Hun Sen. But, you know, I would love it. It's never going to happen. But to get like 5 hours on the record with him in a room, I think would be unbelievable, because I think there is this notion that he kind of set the stage for the post-Cold War dictator and the post-Cold War kleptocrat in a way that we don't really connect, in the sense of he has no values, like has no ideology. I mean, he's the ultimate kleptocrat. Exactly. I mean, he was what? He was Khmer Rouge, which is like super anti-Vietnamese, was a Vietnamese general, came into power in Cambodia, played the democratic role for a little bit, and then just like became super autocratic, but was a security partner of the United States and is now veering towards a security partner of China. And he's someone who just cares about himself, staying in power. So anyway, I would love to do a biography of Hun Sen. That would require interviews that I think are not going to happen. And there would be like 10 interested readers. So I think I'm probably not going to do that. But the other idea I've been kind of toying with, and I haven't made so much progress, is looking at the failed democratic transitions since the end of the Cold War and thinking, well, what went wrong here?
Yeah.
And then in the conclusion, kind of charting a path of mistakes. So I would actually open with Cambodia from the 91 to 93 UN intervention and thinking, well, why did the UN fail? And I think the argument there is, you know, complete optimism, a way over optimistic foreign policy elites who kind of came in and tried to democratize a country they didn't really know anything about. They didn't really leave Phnom Penh because it was too dangerous. They didn't really understand that, as is often the case, capital cities are a mirage and the real country exists outside, that is too dangerous for you to go to. So I think I would open with Cambodia, but you would kind of think you could talk about Myanmar, think about the Obama administration, you could talk about Tunisia. And it's not just about Western involvement. I think it's some of these domestic ones as well. So why is Egypt not a democracy? Why did the Arab Spring fail?
Right.
And as much as the irony of whereas Cambodia was foreign policy elites failing, I think Egypt was domestic elites failing, and domestic elites being way too optimistic and kind of mired in the intelligentsia and disconnected from the rest of the country that was just frustrated with Morsi for a variety of reasons. So that's something I've been thinking about. Haven't made so much progress. I've written a little bit of a Cambodia chapter, but I think that would require it would require more time and more ability to actually travel and report and kind of get back to my journalistic roots, I guess.
Great. Well, it sounds like a fascinating project. If you get to it, I'd read it. Charles, thanks so much for joining us. Charles Dunst is the author of Defeating the Dictators, How Democracy Can Prevail in the Age of the Strong Man. It's a great read, a timely and important contribution. Go out and get it at your bookstore.